Hiya and welcome to Brain Injury Bites, where we provide help and advice for people after a brain injury. My name's Brooke and I've lived with a traumatic brain injury since 2007.
Hi, I'm Ashwani and I'm a trustee at Headway Warrington. I'm also a senior associate solicitor focusing on catastrophic injury, including brain injury.
Thank you for returning to listen to part two of this interview.
You must come across patients who have really high expectations of where they want their recovery to go, or, you know, wanting to get back to exactly how they were beforehand. And it must be very difficult or challenging to manage those expectations. How do you go about that?
Brooke just used the word acceptance before. Mm. Acceptance is a fairly complicated term, really. If you commonly we think of acceptance as almost like put up and shut up. This is the way it is. Just get on with it. But acceptance can almost be a release as well. It's like, I know what I'm dealing with now. Mm. And because I'm fully aware of the difficulties which might go with that, I'm in a better position to adapt, to change, to modify, and still move forward. And that's the work that we try and do with patients who are often said, I just want to be back how I was. Usually the breakthroughs in terms of speeding up their recovery comes, this will sound quite cruel, at the point when they realise, I'm not going to be like I was.
Yeah.
Life has changed. But if we've got the support, right, if we've involved family, loved ones, services, in letting them know we're here to help you move forward from this position and build up a satisfying, fulfilling, happy life.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully we can take some of that pain away. But we've talked about grief before, haven't we? And the analogy extends there with grief. There's an inevitable sadness, isn't there? We have lost a loved one.
Yeah.
We cannot have bereavement counselling with the intention of just feeling happy through it all the time. There is a sadness about what has happened.
And it's a loss of identity. It's such an intrinsic part to somebody's self being.
Sure.
So it must be quite a process to manage. You mentioned their family as well. And I mean, obviously, I think we've spoken about this before in terms of, you know, how family and friends can play a role in people's recovery. But how do you involve them as a clinician? What sort of things do you have friends and family doing with you or with your guidance to promote somebody's recovery?
Obviously, it always has to be with the patient, the person's permission to involve family. But once we've identified that we need a team approach and family, loved ones, friends are part of the team to support this person, it really depends what the person's problems are. But let's say there are cognitive problems, so problems in processing information and thinking. And as a result of an assessment, we've worked out that the person's memory problems are affected by their distractibility.
Yeah.
So they struggle to pay attention. Mm. And typically this is a mental function we take for granted. You think about times when you might be in a crowded room, say at a party, there's lots of chatter going around, but you're speaking to one person, your brain automatically is registering there's noise going around, but it filters that out so that you're concentrating on what the person's saying to you. Well, sometimes after an acquired brain injury, that those filters aren't working. So everything's crowding in on the person. It's very overwhelming. So if we've assessed that to be a problem and this person's struggling in busy family life, we have to work with that family to say, if you've got important communication, let's work out how that communication is given. What environment is it in? So let's say, for example, it's a couple with several young children. If the partner, the person with the acquired brain injuries, has to communicate some important information, let's not do it at a time when you've got the three kids bouncing up and down, wanting to tell you about X, Y, and Z simultaneously, because the person won't cope with that. So some of it will be helping the family member understand the nature of their cognitive difficulties and set up an environment which helps the person to overcome those difficulties or function better, should I say. It might be that there's work to be done on changes in behaviour. So if a person's more irritable or short-tempered, is to help the family understand why that's happening. Maybe they're overwhelmed. Maybe they're sleep deprived. Help them not take it personally, but prompt them to do certain things which might help them calm down or feel, yeah, you don't need to feel threatened by me here. I'm here for you, reassure you, and then hopefully.
I can massively relate to that, especially with in conversations. Obviously, you can get overwhelmed by the noise in the room, the poor lighting, and you know, the other conversations going on around you. I would just add to that that one thing that used to go through my head is that like, people find me boring. They're getting bored here. Leave this person alone. And I'd kind of make an excuse to get out of the conversation as quickly as possible. That's when my confidence was really at my lowest. I'd say one thing I've learned to do is to make the situation ideal. Like if you're going to have a conversation, make sure it's in like a quiet room. Unfortunately, what I wanted to be was I wanted to be back as a young person, back in nightclubs and stuff. But the best possible environment for me would have been like Tuesday afternoon in a well-lit coffee shop.
But that's learning about yourself, isn't it? That's a brilliant example of the accepting this is the way things are and adapting and realising, well, I can still enjoy myself. I can still socialise. I can still have a good time. I just have to do it in a slightly different way now. So that is a brilliant example of what I was talking about there, of our role for some people is to help them accept and adapt and build a life in different ways.
I would continue to do these things, like put myself in those situations with such as like, you know, late night bars or whatever, and I would continue to, it would just make me exhausted. And when I used to get so tired, especially when you mentioned those exercises where you're counting the number of the word the is written, I remember just the tiredness you used to get from that. You used to get such like a headache, and you just used to get this fatigue tiredness. It was just like an exhaustion that I'd never ever experienced before. Touch wood, it doesn't happen as much now. I mean, it can under very specific circumstances, but it was something that I've really had to do a few times before I realised that this is not working for me. And like you said, socialise in a different way. And I think it's so helpful to have somebody who understands, and rather than...
I guess it's educating your friends and family. Yeah, this is I can't cope with what I used to do. And coming back to the grief point and working with families, I guess it's also, you know, a lot of them will be going through the same sort of grief, like losing the person that was and adapting to the person that is now, working with them, trying to find ways to come up with those strategies, as you've mentioned, for example, how to present information, etc. But at the same time, you know, realizing that we're dealing with somebody who has changed and isn't likely to go back to 100% how they were before. And that can be tough, particularly, I think we've spoken about this in previous episodes, particularly in relationships. It's a very different person to who they were before, and that can be such a huge loss on both sides.
You can just become obsessed with the person before you were before, and you can look through rose-tinted glasses, can't you, and you just think, I want to be that person, but you don't realise that what's actually happening now is your life's not necessarily stopping, it's taking a different turn, and other opportunities, you know, can open up for you, and other doors can open up, and if you can look at it in a positive way, it doesn't have to be all negative.
There's an important concept you're both touching on there, which we call post-traumatic growth. So obviously we're all very familiar with the concept of post-traumatic stress and all the negatives which come with traumatic experience. But we're beginning to understand a little bit more about some of the developments, the positives which can come out of trauma, you know, greater insight, different priorities in life, different degree of ambition for some people, better quality relationship because people have gone through a re-evaluation of what's important to them in life. And it's a topic which is a bit sensitive because when people really are struggling in the early days, probably don't want to hear somebody saying, oh, you know, these areas will improve and in some ways you'll be grateful for these changes in your life. They're not feeling it at that stage and you can't expect them to. But for some people, you've just got to be alert to the fact that can be happening. And I think when it does, we have to acknowledge it, we have to celebrate it. Like I mentioned before, there's great inspiration in some of these situations for a lot of people, or for a lot of tragedy and difficulty, obviously. But I think it's important to be open-minded to some of the developments and the positive changes which can come out of certain situations.
Yeah, and I guess also celebrating those positive changes, yeah. The milestones, however small they may be, celebrating those successes can then sort of, I guess, create a more positive recovery journey, because you can see the progress as it goes through. It's not about, you know, running that marathon straight away. It is those small steps, and it's like your 1 minute, 2 minute, 5 minute film thing.
Acknowledging it as well, because one thing you do have is you have a poor memory now, and you don't realise how far you've come on, because, you know, you see yourself every day and you just forget it, don't you? Like, I remember if I'd seen somebody that I hadn't seen for, like, say, 6 months, then that they would, this is in the early stages, they would say how much better I was and how much they noticed I'd improved. But, if you just do it, you're seeing yourself each day, you just don't see that there's any improvement at all.
And one exercise I encourage people to do, sometimes with the help of family and friends, is to keep a diary of their progress. So if you're working, for example, on memory function or concentration, typically what people will do, especially early stages, is compare themselves how they are now with the neurological condition to how they were before they had the trauma or became ill. And with this diary, we say, okay, compare yourself how you are now to how you were just after you became ill or had the accident. Mm. And then compare yourself to how you were a couple of weeks ago. So you've always got this awareness. Oh, no, things are moving. Yeah. It might be tortoise pace, but hey, it's moving in the right direction. Yeah. And that's a really useful exercise to do. And it's nice for family to get involved in that as well. Because, like you mentioned, family going through their own grief, but for them to say, actually, things can get better.
I suppose it's a very interesting perspective. It's a different way of looking at it, I guess, because if you're comparing yourself to how you were pre-trauma, pre-whatever the incident was, before the incident, before the trauma, you were up there and now you're perhaps down here, and it's almost like that massive mountain to get to. Whereas if you kind of start almost from the bottom of post-trauma, this is where you were, and then this is where you are now, and, you know, look at all this space that you've grown just in that short time. It's just reframing the narrative in a way, and getting people to look at things more positively. I find that really interesting.
Somebody said to me once that I should video myself, and I really wish I had have done. But you're always thinking that you're as recovered as you're going to get. But they said to record myself speaking. Because my mouth used to be, I don't know if we've been weaker on one side, but I used to speak appallingly, and I used to stammer, I used to stutter, and I really wish I'd have had some sort of recording of those times.
But, Brooke, the fact is you're aware of it. You know in some ways, because you've worked so hard on this recovery, you've got your mental trace of how things have gone for you, because the amount of effort you have put in to overcome these difficulties has been phenomenal. I remember those days well, sat in a really decrepit office in the old part of the building. And
I was going to say that, old office. I always remember going up them stairs in quite a stressed state, and then I would always come back quite happy. The trip down the stairs was always happier than the trip up. So maybe that's credit to you, Russell. I don't know.
Yeah, sign of a job well done.
But some of those sessions, you could only manage about 10 minutes of you, of me.
Yeah.
Really? Like, many people might say, 10 minutes of you, Russell, is more than enough. But even in terms of your fatigue and your ability to think through what we were talking about, some of those early sessions were very limited, weren't they? But again, with building up stamina, you managed to do that.
There was always I don't know what it's called, pottery. It's like this big picture in your waiting room, and it said something like, "Don't look back, you're not going that way." I thought that was really good.
I'd like to sort of go on a slightly different tack, if I may. Just wanted to talk about some of the different tests that you do when you first start working with somebody, what those tests are, what kind of information they give you. I appreciate you can't necessarily go into too much detail about some of them because of the nature of the tests, but, you know, how that feeds into your planning then for somebody's rehabilitation pathway. And also just the kind of any tips you might have for anybody who is about to undergo a neuropsychological test battery, because they can be quite intensive.
Our assessment process, first of all, people always meet a qualified clinician who will interview them, perhaps with relatives, people who know them well around, and they'll have full medical history as well. So we know quite a bit about the person, what they've been through before we meet with them. And then we'll sit them down and have an hour or so with them talking about how they feel, what problems they have. And through that, we're observing certain things, like we'll be making observations about their memory for names, for example, their confidence in speech. Do they have any word finding problems? Whether they are struggling to understand some of the questions we're asking. Getting a measure of their comprehension, various things that we're observing during interview. And based on what we know about their condition, our initial observations, what we find out in interview, we'll then come up with a fuller assessment plan. So typical areas of cognition that we would be looking at are concentration and attention. So is a person distractible? Are they easily knocked off course? Can they attend to a couple of things at the same time? We would be looking at memory, and memory is a very complex phenomenon. So we've got short-term and long-term memory, we've got visual and verbal and auditory memory, and we've got recognition memory. So if you recognize something, it shows the information's gone in there, you just struggled to get it out spontaneously, or free recall memory. So I've introduced a lot of complex concepts there, but I just want to get across that assessing somebody's memory will involve several tests, so that we work out where is the breakdown for them. And so, and then we look into what we call the executive functions. So these are functions of the frontal lobes of the brain involved in problem solving, abstract thinking, creativity, a whole range of analytical, mainly problem-solving-based functions. And we've got tests for each of these areas. And we've got tests for language function and tests for visuospatial functioning as well. So without wanting to go into too much detail, a typical concentration and attention task might be getting somebody to listen to a series of beeps. And we're asking them simply to listen to this string of beeps and count how many there are. And then, because we're pushing people a bit, and perhaps we're a bit cheeky, a bit naughty with people, we'll introduce a distraction. So I want you to count this beep, but ignore this other one that's a different pitch. It might be a higher pitch. So then we think, can they distract themselves from other things, or does that overwhelm them? Yeah. So that might be one concentration and attention task. The examples of memory tests might be lists of words that we get people to hear, and then they have to repeat back as many as they can remember. And we do this over several sets of the words to see if they're learning as time goes on. And we might do the same with visual diagrams as well, see if they can copy simple line diagrams and see if they learn those over time as well. With memory tests, we might get them to try and remember a bit of information and then test them with two options. Did I say that the woman's name was Mrs. Green, or does I say it was Mrs. Brown? And then I know, oh, it was Mrs. Green. You've recognised it. The information's in there, but I'm not so sure you would have got it with free recall spontaneously. Yeah. We might have needed a prompt. And various problem solving tasks we would do separately to that. So little like construction problems, building a tower out of little discs of wood, move it from one place to another according to certain rules. So these are higher level problem solving tasks which we get people to do.
You know, it's interesting. I was talking to a colleague the other day, and I was just saying how I would absolutely love to undergo a neuropsychological battery.
I'm absolutely fascinated when I read about these things and just think, you know, it'd be really good to have an understanding of where I am now. Also because, you know, thinking a little bit morbidly, if anything were ever to happen, it would be a really good baseline to understand.
I absolutely hate them.
I think they just take me back to like doing a lot of verbal reasoning exercises when I was younger. I don't know, my mum had me doing bond papers for years. So anyway, I digress.
And that's one thing we say to people is it'll feel a bit like being back at school and doing some classroom tests and tasks. And so part of your question was how do people prepare for them? Well, I would say in a way, less preparation is better, because if you get yourself anxious about it, or you get worried about what if it shows this, what if it shows that, then when it comes to doing the tests, we're not always getting a picture of how your neurological condition has affected your performance. We're possibly getting an effect of how your anxiety and all these worries is affecting you. Because if you're trying to remember a list of words, but you're simultaneously thinking, they're going to think I'm really bad at this, and what will this mean? And well, you're not listening to the list of the words. We do try our best to relax people, try and make them as comfortable, try and reassure them if they've got specific worries, make sure that, you know, they've got a cup of water, or let them know that they can take a break at any point if they want. Always feeding back to us how they're experiencing it, so that we can't reassure and say, oh, you're doing great, because we simply don't. That they're being tested, but in terms of their engagement with it, we're just trying to let them know, that's fine, you're doing exactly what we want.
I guess my question in relation to preparation was more things like, you know, making sure you get a good night's sleep, perhaps having the testing at a time of day that works better for you, a bit like Brooke's Tuesday afternoon in a quiet coffee shop thing, you know, just not when you've had a really bad night and you've not slept, or not like late on in the evening, that kind of thing, finding the optimum time.
A good trick is go for a nap just before, 20-minute nap just before. And I heard this on GMTV or whatever it's called these days. It's like caffeine takes 20 minutes to kick in. So I usually have a cup of coffee, 20-minute nap, and I'm good to go.
There you go. You heard it from Brooke first. Brooke's teaching everybody how to ace all of our cognitive tolerance.
But don't drink caffeine after 12, because then you'll regret it at 4 o'clock in the morning when you think you can work out of sleep.
Well, I think that's been really, really interesting and so much food for thought for our listeners. A lot of it also, you know, touches on but expands upon what we've discussed in previous episodes. Thank you very, very much for taking time out of your day to join us. And I know, I'm sure, well, I won't speak for Brooke, but I'm sure he's been very happy to see you again.
Thank you, Russell. Yeah, for the first time I've seen you in 3 years.
Let's see if we can meet up properly again soon, Brooke.
Sure.
No, thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
Please don't forget to follow, subscribe and share our content. If you do have any suggestions for topics that you'd like us to cover, why not drop us a line at hi@braininjurybites.co.uk.